Well, hello, everyone. You're listening to MoboCo Audio. Our podcast today is a follow-up to our popular episode with Carla Braber on the theme of attachment, trauma, and the five keys to reconnection. Now, as a result of that episode, we had a flood of requests for Carla to dive deeper into the relationship between attachment and behavior. And so we begin a series of shorter podcasts on understanding the influence of behavior. This episode explores the premise that all behavior has meaning. Well, it's great to be back together with presenter, author, and behavior specialist, Carla Braber. Carla, I counted the weeks since I've seen you face to face, and I'm up to nearly nine. And since that time, the ice has melted off Deca Lake, and the water birds are back. And last week, you shared a wonderful sunset photo. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm glad to be back in Fort Langley and looking forward to what's coming next.
Good. Now, in our last podcast, we covered a lot of ground, kind of like a band's first album. You think you'll never get another shot to lay it down on vinyl, and so you pour everything out. But here we are again.
I love the metaphor you used, as it describes exactly how I felt when I played back our talk.
Well, I appreciate you coming back. Thank you. Now, are we good today with briefly revisiting the concept of attachment theory and then focusing the rest of our conversation on the first principle of understanding the relationship between attachment and behavior? That is, all behavior has meaning.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's get into it. Can you remind us about what attachment is and the origin of attachment in human relationships?
So attachment is part of everyone's life. It's our relationship with others, especially the people we turn to when we're afraid or we need comfort. I often kind of refer back to those sort of big world moments, disasters per se, as 911 or the current COVID, and think about who are those first people you think of? Who are those connections, those people you want to speak to or get on the phone with? And as a way of sort of describing our attachment relationships. And it exists from birth onwards. It's not something that we grow out of. And children depend on adults and caregivers, both physically and emotionally, in order to survive.
And so how would you describe these attachment patterns?
Well, attachment patterns develop from our experiences in our relationships. So we develop an expectation of how others will respond to us based on these experiences. So a child with a parent or caregiver who responds most of the time when they elicit a need might make the conclusion that adults are mostly dependable and that they're worthy of care. And of course, they don't do this cognitively. And a child who experiences inconsistent care, sometimes someone's there to respond to them and other times they're not, it also could be very unpredictable. They may make a different conclusion about the dependability of an adult caregiver, as well as some concern about if they are worthy of care and if they are lovable. And these patterns develop over the lifespan. Although early life experiences have a powerful impact on our story and our development, these patterns are not set in stone. And each and every one of us has our own unique experience. We never experience something exactly the same, even in the context of a family. So I find it helpful to think about this as our life story. And attachment can be very confusing because sometimes it feels like children are pushing you away, but it doesn't mean that they don't need us.
So it certainly can feel that way at times, mm-hmm. however, that they are pushing us away. Mm-hmm. Now, positive attachment relationships do take attentive effort over time. Now, this sets the stage for what we want to explore today, and that is the premise that all behavior has meaning. So what exactly do you mean by this from an attachment perspective?
Well, if we look at from the moment babies enter into the world, they already begin to communicate their attachment needs. I'm thinking back, Chris, can you remember the first thing your baby did to let you know they needed something?
Oh my, yeah, so many signs. The first, of course, is a cry. Others might be a snuffle, little arms or hands reaching out, mouth movement for nursing. And then I guess as our kids got older, we learned to read all kinds of more subtle signs. Now, we didn't always get it right, of course. Sometimes when the kids were developing, we had to learn and read new signs.
Yeah, absolutely. Did it create a feeling or an impulse for you to respond when they elicited a cry?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I would say as a new parent, it was harder to figure out because we had no real experience to draw from, you know, in terms of what is typical, what was not. We were also just beginning to develop our own beliefs and values and theories about what, quote, effective parenting was all about. Now, things were easier, I would say, with our second daughter. There was a 6 years difference between the two. And by then, we had more confidence because of our experience and the developed knowledge. But again, you know, each kid is different and ours certainly are. Thankfully, our second daughter was more of a sleeper.
That definitely helps. It's also important to remember that patterns of response, the way that we communicate, is also shaped in us as adults, in our parents, by our own family of origin and by our social and cultural expectations. So it's not helpful when we think of attachment in terms of good and bad attachment, but more as an outcome of our experiences. And babies, they use a variety of different ways to let you know what they need without words. And they can really differ from one to another, as you said they did with your daughters. And we try our best to figure out what the cries mean, what the arching and the smiling means. Chris, do you remember a time when your little baby cried and you couldn't settle despite all the different things that you tried? You couldn't settle or figure out what she needed. And how did that make you feel as a parent?
Oh my, yes, that was so frustrating. With our first daughter, there were times when she was a newborn where we could not figure out what the issue was, and so we would try all kinds of things. Does the diaper need changing? Is she hungry? Is she tired but can't fall asleep? You know, thankfully, my partner and I worked well as a team, and we could talk things sort of through the checklist that we had and review the strategies, take turns as needed, spell each other off the work, that kind of thing.
Which is wonderful. And alternatively, do you remember a time when you understood what your baby needed and you were able to soothe them and you were able to actually get them down for their nap? And how did that make you feel as a parent?
Oh yeah, such relief. With her oldest daughter, we found vigorous rocking, for example, really helped her settle and fall asleep as a relative newborn. So we had that strategy that worked and we could rely on it. Of course, until she outgrew it, but it definitely made us feel confident.
Absolutely. And as parents and caregivers, we all try many different things to respond to our child needs. I know that I did a bit of car driving myself, lots of rocking, many different things to try to figure it out. And we refer to this as cracking the code. It's a little bit of a detective mode, really. And some days are better than others. But the point in it all is that we didn't simply give up despite feeling stressed and often exhausted. And behaviors that we just talked about, those crying and suckling and things, they're a form of communicating about attachment needs. And our conclusions, the things that we think they mean, might be accurate some of the time, but they also might be incorrect. And looking at it from an attachment perspective, trying to sort of do that little bit of detective work about what it means helps us to step back and be curious. And I think curious is a really important word. It's curious about what the behavior is trying to tell us. And when we do this, it opens the door to looking at different ways to respond.
His curiosity is so important. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm grateful that my partner and I were able to maintain that mindset along our parenting journey. Not that we were perfect at all. Geesh. Now, Carla, I have to say you're taking me back, and I do have to admit, I'm somewhat glad that those days of newborn parenting are well behind me. Mm-hmm. Now, I also appreciate you framing about how young children communicate to get their basic needs met in that maternal paternal child relationship. But what about the classroom context? How can teachers read students' communication needs and respond to these in a way that supports their needs? So I guess, bottom line, how do we crack that code?
Well, I think the first thing is understanding that attachment needs and strategies of children in our school begins with understanding that's that life story. And it's really, again, we may not have the information. They may not come with a nice file that gives us all their previous life stories. But their behavior, in fact, starts to allow us to make some guesses. And they are guesses about what a previous attachment experience may have been. And it may be filled with many different and sometimes contradictory experiences in past relationships. But this shapes how they express their needs with us now. So this may be especially true with students who have been through multiple placements, stressful life events, trauma, etc.
And what else do they do to express their behavior?
Well, they also express through their behavior when they're feeling safe, when they're soothed, and when they're feeling taken care of, because we see a much more settled child. And what we're really trying to do is we're trying to strive to find a balance between that feeling of feeling safe and connected and sometimes feeling unsafe. And as educators and support staff and parents, we often look at trying to change behavior. So we experience challenging behavior as something that needs to be stopped or something that needs to be fixed. You know, I would argue, though, that our role is to change how children feel. So when a child feels heard or a child feels listened to and understood, that in itself adds an experience to their life story. And so we add another layer to the backpack.
Now, shifting our thinking from an essential focus on changing behavior to first changing how children feel might be a bit of a mind shift, I think, for some. Now, as well, though, it's a good reminder for all of us that our work is not to dig into the past layers in a child's metaphoric backpack, but to add layers of positive experience. And how we do this, of course, is critical. Now, you commented that children need to feel heard, listened to, understood, and in so doing, they end up feeling more secure. Can you talk a bit more specifically about how school folks can promote that feeling of security in children?
Well, we need to build a secure environment for kids, an environment where they feel safe. And that's going to look different from child to child. So that being sensitive and open and curious in how you communicate is really the key. And doing this even when you don't approve or agree with the behavior. So you might never fully understand what the behavior is trying to tell you, because, again, we're trying to crack the code. And by doing that, we're trying to offer different experiences. But your interest and attempts to understand is what, in fact, promotes attachment security. So many of us think that when we get it right, we have the outcome that we hope for. That's good attachment. And when our strategies don't result in the outcome we hope for, it's bad attachment. And as teachers, of course, we're strongly committed to understanding and supporting our students. And when we're successful, we feel effective. But when we struggle and we're not successful, we feel stressed and concerned about our own competency. Am I good enough for the child? Am I able to meet this child's needs? And I just maybe want to reiterate one more time about that it's not getting it right. It's actually giving them another way and a different experience that builds that security. So I'm wondering, Chris, with your extensive experience in education, if you've watched teachers base their competency on whether the child is capable of changing their behavior or not.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. In general, school folks are incredibly dedicated and focused on facilitating success for students. And when that doesn't happen, they can feel they've failed or that they're not competent. Now, this gets expressed in various ways, of course, depending on a variety of factors. I think about professional beliefs and values about behavior management. I think about beliefs and values about a teacher's role in education. And then there are personal factors as well. For example, for some, it can be hard to accept a child's aggressive behavior because they might find it scary or disrespectful. And then for others, it can feel like a loss of control. You know, Carla, as we're talking about this, I realize how hard it is because of those numerous factors for school people to juggle the, quote, business of teaching curriculum with the need to try and understand a child's life story. Now, earlier you explained that we need to create a secure environment for these kids, but how practically, you know, can we go about helping kids feel heard, understood, and cared for?
Oh, I wish there was a step-by-step manual, but relationships are complex and they're always in flux. And as you say, children express their needs in ways that are sometimes perplexing and very difficult to understand. Some children also experience genuine care as threatening rather than soothing. And just to make things a little more challenging, students often miscue the adults, resorting in controlling and sometimes aggressive behavior.
Okay, so let's go into that a little bit more because I'm interested there. Help me to understand what you mean by students miscuing the adults. Can you give me an example of that?
Take the example of a child coming in from the playground, and we find out through all the chatter as they come back into the cloakroom that the child was not included in the game. This might be a historical thing for this little child. So they enter the cloakroom and they start pushing other kids. Now, we can just look at the pushing as of itself and respond to that simply from the behavior not being appropriately. But what would be really important to understand is that underneath all this, he really wants connection and inclusion. But his behavior is confusing. So not only is it confusing for the adult, but it's also really confusing for the child, because he likely doesn't have the emotional awareness or skill set to deal with this.
Right, yeah. So their behavior is really not aligning with an accurate representation of what their needs are.
Yeah, exactly. And I should have said this much sooner, but stepping back to consider what the attachment need, you know, for this child, let's say for an example, doesn't mean that we condone the behavior. It's just that for just a moment, we step back and think of what first. What do we need to understand before we pick what we do next? Because that's definitely going to inform us.
Mm-hmm. So remind us a bit about how we should approach children in these situations then.
Well, I think, you know, if you kind of consider this child's need to be connected first, it's that being sensitive, consistent, our message still consistent, but also curious and empathic, because that can really help us to see a way forward on building on the student's strengths one step at a time. So really to just kind of step back first and, you know, tell me more, tell me what's happened, as opposed to going right to the strategy or the maybe the rule that comes along to pushing, is to first hold that moment in that child in their moment of fear.
Yeah. So it seems hard, though, I guess, not to make assumptions about behavior. We might assume the kid's misbehaving is deliberate. How do we step back from that place?
Well, I think probably the most common description that I hear in all disciplines, and this is from teachers, social workers, parents, etc., is that this child has attention-seeking behavior. They're doing this to get what they want, right? It's the preferred activity, and they don't want to do the math. And, you know, some of that is absolutely true. I know that myself as an adult. I definitely like to do the things that I like to do or prefer and am better at. But if we took that term of attention seeking and we put that in attachment lens, and we view this as connection seeking. So back to that example again, because remember that attachment is a basic human need.
Well, that's a really positive way to reframe that. I like that.
Mm-hmm. And it also alters how you feel about it, because when you take away that sort of context of attention and think about it just in form to get connecting, it really does sort of calm you. So when you flip this perspective, does it give you permission to be more curious and to try different things? Because that's what we're trying to really get at, not to accept it, mm-hmm, but to try a different way to respond mm-hmm. to it that calms the child. Because remember, this is really important, and this is the part that I think we don't think about often, is just as we make assumption of the child's behavior, that child is also making assumption of ours. And it's really easy to lose awareness of that. And it's in our body language, our tone of voice, etc.
Very true. We need to be incredibly self-aware. Now, as you talk about this, I wonder how we do this in a way that balances our being curious with the child's comfort level with being reflective and sharing their story with us.
The goal is not to simply understand or make our best guess about what the behavior means. That's the starting point. Their past experiences maybe make it difficult and scary for them to look at their attachment suitcase. So that's why we need to really stay in that place of curiosity, because we're not in a position to unpack their life experiences fully.
Yeah, no, certainly not. Again, that's such an important reminder. Our role is not to unpack that history, but it's rather to add the new layers of positive caring that better meets the child's needs. So what are your thoughts about how we can respond when we really are having trouble accepting what a child is bringing to us? For let's be real, sometimes we don't connect or we may be frustrated, even angry with a child who is impeding our day plan. How do we manage that?
Well, first you need to have empathy for yourself, because these feelings are absolutely normal. And children who have experienced trauma, for example, become hypervigilant at reading your behavior. So you don't know from one moment to the next what the trigger will be to set them off. And it just changes so rapidly. So we're very adept at making lists. And I encourage you, one way to approach this is to make a list of things that are happening around you when the child is actually doing well, when they're experiencing success. And this list should include things such as, what is the task you're engaged in? Is it math? Is it music? Is it writing? Is it drawing pictures? Who's the child sitting beside? What time of the day is it? What is the setting? Is it light? Is it dark? Is it quiet? And really start to jot these things down. This allows us to focus on what's happening when the child is calm. And it might seem limited sometimes because the child is rarely in that position, but it's also the catalyst to change. Because it's through this understanding that you can build upon these experiences. Because it gives you a little bit of a story on what you might try more of.
Mm-hmm. And we don't always have to get it right, do we?
No. In fact, it's actually quite alarming how little you have to get it right, to be honest with you. It's something like 30 or 40%.
Really?
Yeah. And you may feel like you've gone an entire year and not figured out what the child is trying to express. And guess what? That's actually okay. The child's security is changed by your attempts, by you being there to constantly give them other new experiences. And those stay in their backpack as well as the prior ones do. And statistically, we know that this is actually enough to have a profound outcome in how they manage in later years. Even when you don't witness the results of your hard work, you really matter. And so it's really important to ask for help, because you can't do this alone.
No, absolutely. Now, Carla, thank you so much for this today. You've really helped us to understand what attachment is and how we need to learn to read the communications that children are giving and understand how this relates to their attachment needs. I'm reminded that we need to be curious, avoid those assumptions, attempt to learn their stories, and ultimately work to manage our own levels of emotions and needs as we place the child's support needs at the forefront. Now, what shall we chat about in our next episode?
Well, we talked today a lot about the expression of attachment needs. We kept using attachment needs.
We did.
I'd like to sort of further explore, what is it that our children need in order to grow and develop?
Yeah.
But also, what do we need as educators and support staff in order to grow and develop?
Okay.
Because these have equal value in us being able to manage
All right.
our day-to-day work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like we've got a few more episodes up our sleeves.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks so much. And it's nice to have you back in Fort Langley. And hopefully we could actually get together face to face in the next little while.
Absolutely. And Chris, I wondered if I could add one thing that I think might be helpful for teachers to hear is that I worked with many adolescents who unfortunately spent some time in custody. Mm-hmm. And I would ask them the question, so who was your favorite teacher or a teacher that you connected with? And what about it? What about them? Was it that you liked or that you felt special? Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that not in one case in many, many years did a child say to me, well, the teacher that I really liked is very competent in teaching fractions.
Yes. Yes.
Never.
Oh, the dagger to the teacher heart.
I'm sorry, folks. I'm sure that comes in there somewhere, I promise. But it's not what they remember. And what they do remember, though, is how you made them feel. And so it's really a connection point. And I've had kids say, you know, I was horrible to this teacher. I didn't even really understand it until I was older. And every morning they welcomed me back. And that's what I remember about them. So it's stick it in there. You matter. And they remember. And just unfortunately, it's always not when you need them to remember.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pay it forward experience, isn't it? We're constantly, pouring into that backpack the good stuff in the hopes that we're going to overlayer all of that other stuff with positivity and a sense of security and attachment for the future. All right, Carla, well, I should let you go. It looks like the sun is starting to peek out. Thank you so much for your time, and let's get together soon.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Well, that was my conversation with Carla Braber on understanding the influence of attachment on behavior. Now, if you liked today's episode and want to dive deeper into Carla's work, you can follow her on Twitter or check out her contact links on the mobocoweebly.com website under the podcast page. Now, we're also hosted on Podbean, so you can check that out. But look out for our next episode in this series titled Attachment is for Life. That's it for this episode of Mobico Audio. My name is Chris. Thanks for listening.